Good morning, Chair, members of the board. I'm Dan Sussman, environmental scientist here in your South Lake Tahoe office, and I also represent the board on the staff-level Nearshore Agency Working Group. Also included in this group are staff members from the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and Nevada Division of Environmental Protection. In the audience today is Shane Rombos from TRPA and Jack Landy walking through the door from US EPA. I'd also like to introduce Dr. Alan Havard of the Desert Research Institute. Dr. Havard is the science team lead for this project, which was undertaken by a team of researchers from the Desert Research Institute, DRI. Right into it. From DRI, UC Davis, and University of Nevada, Reno. I'm here to present to you on the recently completed Lake Tahoe Nearshore Evaluation and Monitoring Framework Report. This is an information item only. No action is requested from the board today, but feel free to give direction to staff. The last time I spoke before you on this issue was October 2012, so just a little over a year ago, and you've also received written updates on the project approximately every 6 months since April 2011. So we're here this morning to present on the Nearshore Evaluation Monitoring Framework Report, but why are we here in the greater sense? Why this focus on the Nearshore? Well, the Nearshore is the part of the lake that visitors and residents interact with the most. Changes in the Nearshore over time have increased interest in managing the Nearshore and the factors responsible for its changing condition. This is an interest that the agencies share with the public.
Manually.
Thank you. So this is not the first time that the Lahontan Board has addressed an interest and a responsibility related to Lake Tahoe water quality. You adopted the Lake Tahoe TMDL 3 years ago this week. The Lake Tahoe TMDL was an effort that sought to answer the questions of what is causing the lake transparency decline. So the answer was fine sediment and nutrients, and what are those pollutants coming from? You know, what can we do to help to restore mid-lake transparency? The Tahoe TMDL was an intensive investigative effort that took 10 years and an investment of $10 million. It answered those questions, and though the board is in the midst of acting on those answers, remember that the time frame for the Tahoe TMDL is 65 years. We're just at the beginning of that. Now, the Lake Tahoe Nearshore is a different environment from the mid-lake deep waters of Lake Tahoe. And the answers about mid-lake transparency, though very much related to the Nearshore, are not exactly one and the same. What is our concern about the Nearshore? Is it changes in algae growth, invasive species, clarity? What is causing those changes? What can we do to protect and restore the Nearshore? These are the complex questions, and this report is the first step towards addressing these questions. Now, I mentioned the level of financial commitment invested in the Lake Tahoe TMDL, and the Nearshore was not our primary focus during the past decade and a half. It is not to say that there has been no work done on Nearshore. In the past 15 years, there's been $2 or $3 million spent on research and monitoring efforts. Funding came from a number of sources, from Lahontan, from the state of Nevada, the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency, federal funds. But prior to this report, there's never been a holistic look at all the data that's been learned from those research and monitoring efforts. There has also not been a holistic approach to addressing the Nearshore. Now, one of the elements of this report was to look at that available data from the research efforts, from the monitoring efforts. And Dr. Havard will discuss this, and he'll also discuss other important tasks that are necessary to evaluate the Nearshore. As for a holistic approach to address the changes in the Nearshore, that's our goal. And after Dr. Havard's presentation, I'll return to the podium and discuss where we're going from here. So with that, Dr. Havard.
Thank you, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here addressing the board today. Does this work? To start, I'd like to emphasize that this was a collaborative project, one of the first really integrated collaborative projects between multiple research institutions here in the Tahoe Basin. Another example of this was the TMDL, a successful collaboration between various research institutes and groups looking at water quality changes in Lake Tahoe, in the deep part of Lake Tahoe, the pelagic zone, over the last several decades, and then what to do about that. Early on, we all recognized, and I'm speaking here about the agencies as well as about the scientists, that the nearshore was an area we had not looked at in any intensive and kind of integrated manner. Although we had a good understanding of what was happening in the mid-lake, we did not know how the nearshore conditions were changing and how to best represent changes in the nearshore. And this project was designed to address that knowledge gap. The co-authors here I'd like to recognize are from the Desert Research Institute, the University of California, Davis, Tahoe Environmental Research Center, and from the University of Nevada, Reno. And you can see that their names are listed here. Let's see if I get the formula working correctly. Some of these names, I'm sure you know John Reuter from UC Davis, who led the TMDL scientific effort. Sudeep Chandra, who's been instrumental in implementing a lot of the practices with some of the agencies here addressing aquatic invasive species. Rick Sussfalk, a colleague of mine at DRI. Jeff Schlato at UC Davis, and Scott Hackley as well, who's been working at Tahoe for quite a long time. And I imagine some of these names you recognize. We had a number of technical contributors, and then we also had the Nearshore Agency Working Group. And this was composed of individuals from your agency, as well as from several of the other resource management agencies in the Tahoe Basin, including the TRPA, Lahontan, of course, Nevada Division of Environmental Protection, and the US EPA. So, so you'll have to advance.
There we go.
Briefly, this project was designed to provide a kind of a long-term look at what had been done in Lake Tahoe concerning the nearshore over the last several decades. And frankly, there isn't a lot. There has been more recently, but as you all know, most of the effort has been focused on the mid-lake. And we recognize that the nearshore monitoring, such as it is insufficient to really characterize how nearshore changes are happening, where they're happening, and what the trends are over time. So we needed a comprehensive and integrated assessment of what existing conditions are, and to the extent that past or historical data was available, how those conditions have changed over time. Next slide, please. So our objectives were to look at the available information going back to the 70s in some cases, and to compile this and analyze this. The project was not designed to collect new data or to go out and do new monitoring. It was largely focused on collecting the information that was currently available, and then to document what we can surmise from existing data. And in the process of that, also to review the existing standards and indicators. As you'll see, there were quite a number of these. This is kind of typical here in the Tahoe Basin. There are a number of standards associated with water quality, with forest health, with landscape conditions. And how do we sort through all of these, and where do we focus efforts collectively as a community to achieve the targets and the objectives that we want without wasting efforts and without wasting funds? And then, as a consequence, you know, how best to design a monitoring program that will allow us to effectively and cost-efficiently assess changes both for the good and for the bad as we implement restoration. We expect to see improvement. In some cases, this may not happen in localized areas of the nearshore. How do we detect this? What's the most cost-effective monitoring approach to detect and say something about where changes are occurring in the nearshore and what's happening over time? Next slide, please. And the products from this project include a compilation of what we understand from the scientific perspective about the conceptual organization of the nearshore, what are the factors and processes important to the nearshore, how do these interact. Again, as I said, an assessment of existing standards and indicators, which of these are particularly relevant to the nearshore. And then finally, a plan, some sort of a framework for how to monitor and evaluate conditions in the near shore over time, and how those conditions change and where they change. Next slide. So one of the first places we start is with a desired condition statement. This is kind of a common and characteristic policy approach. We want to define what our target, what our objective is, and our goal in a very broad sense. We met with the nearshore execs. That included Harold Singer from the Lahontan Board, previous to your coming on board here, Patty, and then some representative from the Nevada Division of Environmental Protection and Joanne from the TRPA. We met with them a few times over the course of this project. This statement was something that was derived early on, and it's that Lake Tahoe's nearshore environment should be restored or maintained to reflect conditions consistent with an exceptionally clear and clean lake. Ultra-oligotrophic is the scientific term for this. For the purposes of conserving its biological, physical, and chemical integrity, protecting human health, and providing for current and future human appreciation and use. Very broad statement, narrative, kind of objective. This then targeted and focused the efforts of the scientific assessment going forward. So this is one of the early statements that we derived. Next. In order to focus that effort, we needed to define what we meant by the nearshore, and that's represented here, where we show that nearshore is extends from the existing lake level. So lake level changes seasonally and annually depending on climate conditions, and it extends at a minimum 350 feet from the existing shoreline, or potentially further. To a depth of 69 feet. 69 feet seems like an unusual number, perhaps. Why 69 feet? That's because it's the depth at which the maximum summer thermocline typically occurs. And so the summer thermocline is a physical structure that sets up in the lake based on thermal dynamics. It separates the upper waters from the upper warm waters from the deep cold waters, and we show that kind of. Did we skip a slide? Or?
I think that comes later.
Oh, let's go to the next slide. And we'll come back to.
Okay, you got it.
This is where I say sometimes I change the order at the last minute. Go to the next one. There, good. So I'd like to point out here this thermocline structure. In this chart up here, you can see that it's a temperature stratification that sets up in the summer as the waters heat up in the lake. And you have warm upper waters that are separated by a rapid change in temperature in the thermocline, and then the deep waters represented here typically in the range of about 4 degrees centigrade. And so this is a common feature to lakes, as many of you probably know. It sets up in Tahoe at a typical summer maximum of about 69 feet. And because of this thermal stratification, it represents a barrier between mixing of upper waters with the lower waters. So in the summer, you have waters at about 69 feet depth or above that are isolated from the deeper, colder waters. And so in terms of monitoring, it makes sense to look at this part of the profile because everything in this area tends to be fairly well mixed and relatively homogeneous on a depth scale, not necessarily spatially, but on a depth scale around in the nearshore. And so if we could go back one slide. There is an existing definition that the TRPA and Lahontan have for the nearshore. And that's at the 30-foot depth contour, which represents a part of the thermocline, but not the entire thermocline. This is a representation of the area around Tahoe City. And as you can see, the yellow line here represents the existing legal definition. And it's quite similar to what we have now for our monitoring definition. This framework allows us to monitor this entire area as a discrete unit. and it's relatively similar to the existing legal definition. So we're not recommending any changes to legal definition of the nearshore. But in terms of characterizing what's happening in the nearshore over time, we're looking at the nearshores extending down to the 69-foot contour. You can see it also tends to smooth out some of the variability here in the nearshore. It's a bit smoother. The blue line here is the 350-foot contour, and in some cases that extends out further than either the 30-foot or the 69-foot depth contour. That represents the minimum distance out from the existing shoreline. That's so that we always have some sort of a buffer for the nearshore from the shoreline, as opposed to having it right up against the nearshore as you would in some cases, like along Rubicon or Crystal Bay, where it drops off very rapidly. Right. So we'll go back to the next slide and briefly talk about that. In terms of the factors that affect the nearshore, this is just a conceptual representation showing some of the typical factors of what's going on in the nearshore. Air pollution, of course, and fire, whether it's controlled burn or wildfire. Urban stormwater runoff, one of the primary factors affecting both the mid-lake and the nearshore. Excess fertilizer runoff, intervening zone runoff, the same as coming from urban areas, largely groundwater and seeps. All of these things affect the nearshore. And they affect the nearshore in a localized way, which is different typically from the effects of these same factors on the mid-lake. So there isn't a lot of difference between what's affecting the mid-lake in terms of clarity and what's affecting the nearshore. But these differences tend to be more localized in the nearshore, and including effects from, for example, recreational boating. So some of these factors are unique to the nearshore. Aquatic invasive species, for example, are often unique to the nearshore, and you don't see them in the mid-lake. But overall, most of these factors are relevant to both the mid-lake clarity as well as nearshore conditions. And then right here you can see we're representing how in the epilimbium, the upper warm waters in the summer, this is the mixed layer. This is the layer where the waters are fairly well mixed, but they're separated by the thermocline from the deeper hypolimnetic cold waters. Next slide. All right, I like this slide. No one else likes it. So I'm speaking as, the scientists like this slide because what we've done here is we've represented all the factors that we think are relevant and important in terms of affecting the nearshore. Now, I'm not going to go through this in any sort of detail because we have a better slide that the agency, our agency collaborators helped us produce. And we'll get to that one next. But what I wanted to do here was simply point out that we have four factors on the right-hand side. These are indicators, our nearshore indicators. We have nearshore clarity, nearshore trophic status, nearshore community structure, and nearshore conditions for human health. And as we go through this presentation, I'll tell you how we derive those particular factors as indicators of the nearshore. But this is the relationship of all the different things important to the nearshore and how they interact and ultimately affect these particular four indicators. We can go to the next slide. I'll give you a little more accessible representation of what's going on. Again, on the right-hand side are our four indicators of nearshore health, and you can see that they are primarily affected by sediments, nutrients, the same two factors that primarily affect conditions in the mid-lake, as well as aquatic invasive species and potentially pathogens and toxins. Those are pollutants that derive from things like urban stormwater, contaminated runoff, excess fertilizer use, all the things you saw in our conceptual illustration are represented here. And this is a summary of the things that were represented in the more complex conceptual model. So this isn't meant to be comprehensive. This is meant simply to be a representation of important controllable factors that we picked out to represent how taking control measures over on the far left-hand side, implementing the TMDLs and the BMPs, controlling shoreline development, and maintaining the integrity of sewer infrastructure All of these then affect the contributions of nutrients and pollutants and pathogens and aquatic invasive species to the near shore that ultimately affect the conditions that we're concerned about. Next slide. So that was our conceptual model. That's, you know, first thing we wanted to do was get our minds around, in both a scientific sense as well as in an agency resource management perspective, get our minds around what are the factors that are principally controlling condition in the near shore. Once we had that, and we had that in the conceptual model, we began to look at what are the existing standards and how do these existing standards relate back to these factors, both in terms of the indicators and the controllable factors that we're interested in managing. And so we looked at the existing standards. The agency representatives we were working with compiled a list of all of the existing standards from Manhattan, from the EPA, from the Nevada Division of Environmental Protection, and from the TRPA. And altogether, there were about 62 of these that were potentially relevant to the nearshore. That's a lot of standards. I mean, how are you going to address and deal with all of those standards? And so it was important from the agency perspective that the scientists look at these and provide some guidance about, you know, which are relevant, which are important, which maybe aren't as important, and what to do about these. And so we looked through all of these, and then we saw that we could sort them into 38 categories where they're pretty much similar, maybe in some cases the same. TRPA, Lahontan sometimes have the same standards, but, you know, they're represented by each group, so with maybe a slight variation in wording. So we found that we could sort these into 38 categories that were internally consistent. And then each of these categories, we reviewed. We assembled, in a preliminary way, we assembled the available information about those categories. So let's say it was something like total nitrogen. So then we assembled the available information that we knew about from our bibliography search and looked at what we knew historically and what we knew from the scientific literature and what we could say about conditions in Lake Tahoe for that particular category, in this case maybe total nitrogen, and then provided some preliminary assessment about its relevance to the nearshore in terms of management and monitoring. Next slide. So this was just an example of a preliminary assessment for total nitrogen, as it turns out. And so we looked at it, and we provided the description, some historical background, some indication of reference conditions, and then if it's relevant for maintaining desired conditions. So we did this for each one of the 38 categories. And that was a brief preliminary assessment. And then here, this is the compilation then of what we came up with after that preliminary assessment. And so you can see these are the 38 categories listed here. Then we have a column for nearshore management and a column for nearshore monitoring. And for each one of these categories, we indicated whether we considered it to be important, relevant, or less relevant for the nearshore at Lake Tahoe. And there are several things that, for example, are important to the nearshore, and maybe they're important for management, but not so important for monitoring, or they're not important for either management or monitoring at Lake Tahoe. An example of that might be, for example, chloride. Chloride is a chemical used in water quality treatment. It can cause issues when it's discharged at high concentrations into the environment, and so it is monitored on a statewide basis. There is a state standard for that, but in terms of the ecological conditions in Lake Tahoe, it's not particularly relevant. So we're not saying get rid of the standard. Obviously, you don't get rid of the state standard that has relevance on a larger scale. But in terms of managing the nearshore Lake Tahoe, it's not very relevant. And so that's an example of how we ranked these various categories. Next slide, please. So once we had these categories evaluated and ranked as important or relevant, We carried the ones that were important and relevant forward then in assessment, and we aggregated these into a smaller list of internally related characteristics. And then that smaller list ultimately provided the basis for the design of our monitoring framework. Next slide. So again, those 38 categories then ultimately were reduced down to the, I don't know how many there are here, 15 or so that you see represented right here. And pretty much all of those categories are still represented in this list. So if you look through these 1 through 38, most of them are still represented here, but we've aggregated them a little bit further and then associated them with a particular indicator relevant to assessing nearshore ecological condition. And so you see here our indicators are nearshore clarity, and you see three things that are associated with nearshore clarity: that light transmissivity, turbidity, suspended sediments. You do have some existing standards that are at least related to these attributes, whether it's transmissivity, turbidity, suspended sediment. Same thing with the nutrients here. And then phytoplankton, periphyton, those are associated with nearshore trophic status. Trophic status refers to the amount of growth, biological growth, your system will sustain. If you have a lot of nutrients available, then the trophic status, the trophic conditions would be different than if you have the low amounts of nutrients available in the oligotrophic system. And then finally, we added a few in here that aren't directly associated with any existing standards, but are still important for evaluation of nearshore condition. That includes things like chlorophyll, macrophytes, macroinvertebrates, fish, and crayfish. Something else I was going to say here. Oh, yeah. So you can see that a few of these rows are highlighted. So transmissivity, turbidity, phytoplankton, periphyton, toxicity, pathogens, chlorophyll, macrophytes. These are the ones that ultimately form the basis of our recommended monitoring design. Some of the other ones, temperature, community composition. Community composition is largely represented here by an evaluation of macrophytes, macroinvertebrates, fish, and crayfish. Temperature is one of those things that's relevant, but in terms of monitoring the controllable conditions in the nearshore, it's not particularly important for a nearshore monitoring program. And that's because what are you going to do about temperature? You know, we're going to see temperature changes with climate change. It's already been shown that we're seeing long-term gradual changes in lake temperatures in the mid-lake. We anticipate there are going to be corresponding changes in the nearshore, but it's not particularly important from a management decision about something that you can control. These other things are all things that presumably you have some management control options to apply. And then finally, I'll point out here that perhaps somewhat surprisingly, the nutrients are not included as part of the monitoring framework. And that is because nutrients are important. They're important for assessing nearshore trophic status, but it's shown in the literature, and it's been shown at Lake Tahoe, that under very oligotrophic conditions like we have here, the nutrients do not directly relate to the concentrations of algae. Algae concentrations can be quite high while nutrient concentrations are very low in the water, and that is because of rapid algal uptake. So there is not a good relationship between nutrient concentrations and the amount of algae and chlorophyll in the water. It's better to measure the amount of chlorophyll and the amount of algae and the effects on transmissivity and turbidity directly, because that's a direct response variable, as opposed to trying to measure the nutrients, which can be very expensive. So it's important to track nutrients. We show that as a secondary metric in our monitoring program, but it's not listed as primary metrics. Next slide. So then this is a representation of how those metrics and indicators are organized in the monitoring plan. And so each one of those highlighted rows in the previous slide is represented down here as a metric. And I think it's important to point out here that in our design of this monitoring program, We considered the metrics to be something that are directly measurable, something that you can measure directly and assign a quantitative value to in the nearshore. And so light transmission, turbidity, chlorophyll, paraffin, the macrophytes, these are all things that you can measure directly and assign a quantitative value to. And then those are used in an aggregated sense to provide an indication of what the nearshore condition is for clarity, for trophic status, for the community, aquatic community structure, and conditions for human health, which ultimately lead up to our original nearshore desired condition statement. And then this is meant to represent the relationships between these metrics, indicators, reference conditions, and our desired condition. And this slide is perhaps simplistic if you understand it, but honestly, the agency representatives and the scientists spent quite a bit of time actually developing a common vocabulary and a common understanding of what we meant. And quite a bit of our effort early on went into creating this common language, if you will. And this is an example of that. What we have here, again, remember we have our indicators. Those four indicators are represented here as a function of each of the individual metrics. So we have our 10 metrics, and in some cases the indicators would be represented perhaps a single metric or some aggregation of some quantitative aggregation of those metrics. For example, if we go back one slide. You can see that we have chlorophyll, phytoplankton, and periphyton are all metrics associated with the trophic status indicator. And that chlorophyll also contributes to the clarity indicator along with light transmission and turbidity. So the indicators can represent some quantitative aggregation of the individual metrics, but the metrics themselves are measurable features of the nearshore environment. And so that's the that's how we look at our indicators and the relationship of metrics to those indicators. And then for each one of those indicators, you would expect a range in that condition. If we were to take turbidity as an example, well then, if we have very good turbidity, then that represents something down on this edge of the spectrum for turbidity, where it's pristine, there's no impairment. But turbidity, as we've all seen at Lake Tahoe, can actually become significantly impaired, to the point where you can't see more than a few feet into the water under some extreme conditions. And so you would have a range of conditions, and obviously your desired condition is going to sit somewhere down in the lower range, presumably in most cases. And where you set then your standard, if you were to set a standard, would depend upon a series of policy and stakeholder deliberations, but it's going to be somewhere in the range that reflects an achievable desired condition. And presumably that would reflect something in the range of what is considered a reference condition, which may be a historical condition, or it may be something that is represented. If we don't have historical data, it may be something that's represented in the literature as typical values for an example for an ultra-oligotrophic system. So a reference condition simply represents kind of what we would expect for the nearshore in Lake Tahoe, for example. And then the desired condition might extend a bit past that, depending upon, you know, how strictly we wanted to try to manage our environment. And the standard, would, if we were to set a standard again for a particular metric or for a particular indicator, would fall presumably somewhere within that range. And it may be a standard that covers a range or may be a point standard. Both of these are typically used in management. Next slide. So ultimately what we did, and the body of the report is really represented here, in the assessment of each one of these 10 metrics. So the 10 metrics that we chose as being particularly relevant for the nearshore because they are response variables. They are the things that are going to change in a very sensitive way to what is happening in the nearshore. So they're going to tell you early, and they're going to tell you with some precision how things are changing and where they're changing. The 10 metrics were evaluated individually in the body of the report in a much more comprehensive sense than you saw with our preliminary assessment when we did the categorization and the ranking. And so what we've done here is we've linked up with each one of these metrics. We show which indicator it's associated with, and then we give some indication of the databases for that particular metric. So each one of these 10 metrics was evaluated in great detail in the report in terms of historical information, in terms of the literature values, in terms of potential reference conditions, in terms of what we've seen in change over time. And then we describe here, we summarize what the databases is for each one of those. And as you can see, in most cases, it runs from poor to moderate, and that's because we have not had a monitoring program in place in the nearshore for Lake Tahoe, except for a few things. Periphyton is an example where we actually say the database is good, and that's because Lahontan and the TRPA and have supported a program of monitoring periphyton in the nearshore. Periphyton is the attached algae that grows on the rocks, makes them slippery. That's something that's very tactile and visual to the people that go to the nearshore. We've all seen it. We've all seen it change over time. But if you can't quantify it, if you can't measure it and say what's happened, then it's really hard to develop any sort of management strategy or standards for that particular metric. So periphyton is one where we do have some data. Even though we have data, it's not excellent because we haven't had a long-term consistent program of periphyton monitoring. UC Davis has gone out they did it, I believe, in the 70s, and then they did it again in the 90s, and they've been doing it a little bit over the past few years, where they're going out annually and measuring it at many locations around the lake. And so we do have a fairly good idea of what things are like and how they've changed a bit, but it's not where there's been a consistent, regular program of monitoring every year for periphyton. And for these other ones, there just isn't a program. For turbidity, for example, we've been out, the TRPA's been out, they've measured turbidity, we've measured turbidity around the nearshore a few times, but this has always been associated with specific projects, research projects. You go out, you do a year of work, and that's it. And if you don't have like consistent techniques, and if you're not going out on a regular basis and doing it, the variability inherent to the environment, especially in the nearshore, is so great that it's very hard to reduce that invariability into any sort of trend or assessment. So the databases for most of these is pretty poor, simply because we have not had a monitoring program for the nearshore like we have had for the mid-lake. Next slide, please. So this is periphyton. This is the attached algae. And this is the one where we actually do have a fairly decent databases. These are some fairly extreme cases of periphyton growth in Lake Tahoe. And remember that periphyton is fueled primarily by nitrogen and phosphorus. The TMDL, focused on mid-lake clarity, is focused more on sediment than it is fine sediment particles that remain in suspension. It's focused more on that than it is on nitrogen and phosphorus, the nutrients. And appropriately so, because in the mid-lake, the fine suspended particles are what are contributing the major amount to clarity loss. So about 60% of clarity loss is due to suspended fine particles in the water column. Whereas in the nearshore, the periphyton and the algal growth is primarily associated with contributions of nitrogen and phosphorus. So this is a slide that shows you the periphyton and how it's changed over time. And really, I just put this up there to demonstrate the amount of variability associated with this particular single metric in the nearshore. And you can see that there are very many zones around the lake where it's either quite good or where it's deteriorating. So typically with the urban areas. And you can see how it's changed over time as well from 2008 to 2011. So this gives us a basis now to begin to look at what are the causal factors. If you know where conditions are changing and where they're deteriorating relative to the rest of the lake, then you would track back up into the watershed to determine what factors there are contributing to this deterioration in specific locations in the nearshore. Next slide. And this is a similar slide showing the variability associated with light transmissivity in the nearshore. So again, here's our 69-foot contour for the nearshore for monitoring purposes in Lake Tahoe. And you can see how light transmissivity varies around the lake in this particular instance. And I did not put the date on here, so I don't know when that was. But what I'd like to point out is the fact that if we were to extend this out into the mid-lake, we would probably only be using two, maybe three of these categories at most. And that's why, to date, there has not been much focus on the nearshore. It's because of this variability, both spatial and temporal variability, and the fact that it is difficult to assess that in the nearshore compared to assessing it in the mid-lake. A classic dissertation question is if you were to monitor a lake and you could monitor the lake vertically or horizontally, which would you do? And the answer is you would choose, and you could either monitor it vertically at a few points, or you could monitor it vertically at a few points, let's say 5 points, or you could monitor it horizontally at a few points, let's say 5 points. You would choose vertically because most of your variation in the lake, in the large part of the lake, is associated with that vertical dimension because of that stratification I was talking about, because of that thermal stratification. You have more variability in the vertical dimension in the mid-lake and less in the horizontal direction. And so the classic approach in monitoring and evaluation of lakes is to go out and to set up a couple of index points and to go out there and measure those regularly and provide a depth profile and track how that changes over time. And that's what we've done at Lake Tahoe. And that's why we have a record that shows what's happened with lake clarity over time, with the Secchi disk, and how that has changed over time. For the worse, over time, about 1 foot loss per, what is it, quarter foot per year, I think, is about what the long-term trend was until recently. And over the last 10 years now, I'm sure you've all seen how that trend has leveled out on an annual basis, and how we're seeing, instead of clarity loss, we're seeing a change in that trend to the point where we can actually say the clarity loss appears to have stopped. We are not losing clarity in Lake Tahoe, in the mid-lake, anymore on an annual basis. Now, there are some subtleties to that, but without the data, without the long-term data, we would not be able to say that. If you can't measure it, if you can't quantify it, it's really hard to say how conditions are changing, especially in a lake, in a oligotrophic lake like Lake Tahoe, where conditions are so clean and the changes are so small that they're difficult to measure. And so, in a classic sense, we did the most efficient thing that we could in terms of monitoring and evaluating Lake Tahoe. We went out to the middle of the lake. We established a couple of index stations. We measured those intensively over time, and we were able to say how it was changing. We did not look at the nearshore as intensively because it's inherently more complex. There's a lot more spatial and temporal variability associated with the nearshore than there is in the mid-lake. And so it's a lot more difficult, it's a lot more expensive. It wasn't the priority at the time, but it has become the priority now. And going forward, we did develop what we consider the most effective and efficient, cost-efficient monitoring approach. And that would be the next slide, which is represented here. And I know this is a crowded slide. All I'm going to do is point out that we've got our 10 metrics here. We indicate when to go out and monitor those and where to do it, how to do it, and then provide some additional indication. And this is just a summary of what we provided in the report. In the report, we actually provide four metrics that are available for monitoring now. We provided more detailed approaches and methods and standard operating procedures, for example. This is just a summary to show when and how you monitor these things. And many of these things are done at the same time. And they're all coordinated in terms of spatial and temporal distribution so that ultimately the data can be compiled and analyzed in aggregate. And that's the important part of doing an integrated, holistic assessment of inertia. I think that was the last slide. Yeah. So, Dan, did you have a few to finish up here?
I do. Okay.
And then I'll be available for questions if there's anything.
Hi there. Thank you, Ellen. I recognize you guys have been a captive audience for a while, so I just have three slides, but in the midst of them, if you feel like standing up, stretching your arms, feel free, I won't take offense. I want to provide you a recap of the key points of Dr. Haber's presentation. First, as those last few slides indicated, the nearshore is a heterogeneous environment. As an example, inputs from the watershed in many places have not mixed well on the near shore as they have when they're in the deep water zone. Similarly, their responses can be localized with more algae growth in some parts of the lake, less in others. One metric can change from season to season or year to year. Second bullet. No, same slide. Second bullet. Among these three agencies, Lahontan, Nevada Division of Environmental Protection, and TRPA, there are 62 standards applicable to the near shore. Some of these, like boron and radioactivity and chloride, they aren't that relevant to what our goals are with the nearshore. But a good number of the existing standards are important. They are relevant. A monitoring plan is needed. Not a lot of key parameters have solid data, with the exception of the paraffin that he was speaking of. They may have good quality data when the data was taken, but the quantity of it might just be a snapshot taken every 10, every 20 years. And finally, some of the current efforts underway will benefit the near shore, and so let's take a look at those. As mentioned, Lahontan has a contract for Lake Tahoe monitoring with UC Davis Tahoe Environmental Research Center. It's a 3-year contract. It's $150,000 a year for the past 10 dozen years or so, and it's money that's been spent for the past 10 or a dozen years on a mix of near shore and mid-lake metrics. Now, this year, when the contract was renewed, it was scoped to place more focus on the near shore with paraffin and phytoplankton monitoring. And the scope of this contract does not constitute a near shore monitoring plan in it of its own, and it's really only a temporary measure. We're kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul with this in terms of taking some of the money from our needed mid-lake monitoring and just for this contract period putting it on the near shore. And this is a shift in resources that does allow a temporary focus. But a temporary focus on just a couple of the monitoring parameters that were in Alan's last slide. And as Dr. Haber mentioned, the implementation of the Lake Tahoe TMDL should help with the near shore, specifically stormwater, stream restoration, and source control projects, as there is overlap in pollutants of concern. Tahoe has a robust aquatic invasive species program. It focuses on prevention, detection, and control. And I'll caution that the prevention program has been successful in part because of the political will and financial backing which might be reduced with the expiration of the Southern Nevada Public Land Management funding source, though there is optimism about securing funds through other sources from both California and Nevada and some bills that have recently been passed by both those states. Also, please note the distinction here between control and eradication. We specifically say control here because with a lot of aquatic invasive species, we're really unlikely to eradicate them entirely, but remain cautiously optimistic that given funding and a little bit of time, infestations can eventually be reduced to maintenance levels or eliminated entirely in some portions of the lake. TRPA recently adopted a new regional plan, and this regional plan update includes new and updated land use policies and other regulations that could help reduce pollutant input to the nearshore. Several TRPA staff are in the audience today, and they could answer questions about that a lot more accurately than I can. Finally, there are three large sewer districts here in the California side of the basin. There's the Tahoe City Public Utility District, North Tahoe, and South Tahoe PUDs. As you may recall, as required by Portofluin and the California Water Code, all wastewater in Tahoe is exported out of the Tahoe Basin, and so there is a nutrient source that does not go straight to the lake. And while sewage leaks are prohibited, leaks can happen, and that further highlights the need for aggressive sewer line surveys and maintenance. So moving forward, while we're here today to talk about this report, we recognize that this report is not the be-all, end-all of our attention on the nearshore. While we here in Tahoe are interested in preserving the nearshore, you know, the nearshore has also been of interest down in Sacramento. And this past year's budget bill language included the request for Lahontan to report back on her plans for taking the findings of this report, delivered, developing some sort of a schedule, and moving forward. Loosely, what this means, if you give me another clip, thank you, means that we are to develop a schedule for nearshore standards and develop a schedule for helping to restore and maintain the nearshore environment. And this is a top priority on my desk. I've been directed to develop a draft for internal review before the new year. We don't have any statutory requirements that would require us to open that report down to Sacramento to the public for public review, but we think it's important to get public feedback on this prior to finalizing the report. So we hope to have a public-ready document for public review sometime in January. And that will allow us to receive and incorporate input from the public and our public agency partners before finalizing a schedule and sending it down to Sacramento in March. Now, while that key reporting task is important to complete, I want to highlight some of what I anticipate to be its key elements, our needs, our responsibilities moving forward. So establish a monitoring program and get it funded. The report is clear that additional monitoring is needed to help better understand nearshore conditions and how and when conditions are changing through time in response to the current inputs and in response to the pollution control efforts. You've seen a summary of monitoring needs as put forth in the report. Lahontan, with the help of the Nearshore Agency Working Group, TRPA, EPA, and Nevada, Division of Environmental Protection, will investigate funding opportunities and refine the monitoring program described by Dr. Haver to align with those funding abilities. I've mentioned the existing contract our agency has with UC Davis, as did Dr. Haver, and also, so that's one opportunity for funding. Recently passed State Senate Bill 630 should provide some matching funds for nearshore monitoring, and so that's funds that are to be matching funds for Lahontan funds or other public agency funds for nearshore monitoring. But at this time, we can't predict exactly how much funding will come from that source, nor the timeline of its availability. It could be this next fiscal year. It could be full matching. That's speculative at this point. Another funding source we hope to use to kickstart this effort are grant funds from the Nevada Division of State Lands License Plate Fund, and the Nearshore Agency Working Group plans to submit a request for that in the new year. Dr. Haver mentioned causal assessments, and the report identifies likely sources of pollutants, but doesn't investigate the specific sources of the pollutants at the watershed, at the sub-watershed level. For that, we need to conduct these causal assessments. You know, what's happening at a specific location? What is causing this change in the nearshore? Is it a natural condition? Is it some pollutant sources that you can point to and maybe control, or is it likely a combination of the two? It's probably going to change depending on what the location is. This is a funding need that we recognize, and we've submitted a proposal to the State Board for a State Board process for contracting funds, and that's a process that's just starting for this year's round right now. Public engagement is up there, and it's up there as the last bullet, but I wouldn't place it there in necessarily in importance. We recognize that our concern for the nearshore is shared by the public, and it's important for us to share our information with the public and have opportunities to hear from them as well. Today's presentation is one such opportunity. The TRPA Governing Board, this past October 23rd, they heard a similar presentation by Dr. Havert and were able to present feedback if they so desired. But this is really a big report. You know, we talked about it being 300 pages, but I took a look back at it, and with appendices, some of which are those tasks that were Alan talked about, it's over 400 pages long. So understandably, it takes some time to review and to digest a work of that length. In a few months, when everyone's had a chance to at least take an initial look and to digest the report, the Nearshore Agency Working Group looks forward to hosting a public workshop or listening session to hear the public's ideas as well as to share some of our own. And we anticipate that workshop to be in January, and we can hopefully have it coincide with the release of the schedule for public review that I mentioned earlier in this slide. And this won't be the only opportunity for the public to weigh in as we develop and implement our nearshore approach. Once monitoring and research efforts have been implemented, and we've had an opportunity to further our understanding of the nearshore, we'll be able to revisit our current regulatory programs and see if perhaps there are opportunities to leverage them for the benefit of the nearshore, but we don't want to do that if it concedes their primary purposes. So those are decisions that would obviously come to the board. And with that, I thank you for your time, as well as those in the audience, and turn the floor back to you, Chair Pumphrey, and for any questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm pleased to note that State Board Member Dee Dee Diadamo is here with us. We are always glad to see her here. Especially when we're talking about all the things we'd like help with. What I think I'd like to do is ask for questions from board members and then go to public commentary. Mr. Dias?
No questions.
Mr. Sandell?
There are many questions that could come out of this, but I think I'm really interested to know where you think this will wind up at a practical level. I mean, you imagine that we're going to be doing things like limiting the kinds and the quantities of fertilizers you can buy at these hardware stores to put on the lawn, or where will this go eventually, do you think?
I guess I have two answers for that. One of those answers is that's part of this exploratory process. And when I said putting together a schedule for State Board, a lot of that schedule is trying to figure out what's appropriate. Are there new efforts that we can take to reduce inputs? Is it management efforts? Do we want to explore what we learn from monitoring and what we learn from these causal assessments and what they'll tell us in terms of will a new standard help us, or is that effort better put towards just doing actual implementations and policy changes? So that's something that I will hopefully develop along the way. The other answer to that, you mentioned fertilizer, and I think that's more of a question that I would direct to TRPA because they have new policies towards that.
Thank you.
Ms. Cox.
I had a question on slide 18. If you could bring that, Sue. And this is my first exposure to Tahoe, so I found the presentation absolutely fascinating. There was a mention that there are 62 miscellaneous standards that have been kind of distilled into this chart. And then at the bottom, N through Q have been added. Are those now considered new standards, or are they a way to gauge existing standards?
So the 62 standards referred to at the beginning of this project a few years ago, one of the tasks of the Nearshore Working Group, as opposed to the science team, was to comb through our documents and really make a list of all the standards that we have that are applicable to the near shore. Those four don't really fall anywhere in there directly, and so Alan, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that you've added those as items that should be monitored because they're metrics that represent the health of the near shore that we don't have right now, and it isn't necessarily a recommendation to create standards associated with them, but because they're important to analysis of the trophic status and community structure of the near shore, they've been put forth.
Okay, because the slide heading says existing standards, so are these going to be metrics?
No, that's just a misrepresentation on my part, carrying forward a title from previous slides, kind of talking more about the process where we were assessing existing standards and using that ultimately to derive a subset of important response variables that could be related back to those existing standards. So none of these, outside of really turbidity, and some of the nutrients, are directly our standards, if you will. These are represented here as nearshore attributes that would be monitored. And so, but there are standards that are either directly or peripherally associated with these attributes. And that's, I think, what was important to represent here, is that these are not just, in, for the most part, just attributes that we're throwing out there and saying, well, you know, these are new important things that you should be measuring, and your standards, maybe you need to measure those too. The idea really is these are important factors, attributes that you should be measuring in the nearshore because they are response variables that directly respond to changing conditions in the nearshore and the watershed that affects the nearshore. And then the four at the bottom were things that were not represented directly in existing standards. So we threw them in because they are important for evaluating nearshore conditions related to that kind of community, aquatic community structural composition. What are the native species that exist there? And what is their distribution and abundance? And how is that changing over time? Related to fish, related to macroinvertebrates. We made it to related to the plants, the macroinvertebrates. Both the native and the invasive ones that are growing in the nearshore.
And these four indicators are unique to the nearshore rather than the center?
Yeah, certainly in the case of macrophytes and the macroinvertebrates, it's largely associated with the nearshore. The fish and crayfish, obviously, you know, they are pelagic as well, so they go out into the deeper part of the lake. And there is an existing fish standard represented in the community composition attribute that the TRPA has, but that's in the community composition. It wasn't specific enough for our purposes.
Thank you. That was very helpful. It helped me to get a better understanding of that. No more questions, Chair.
Mr. Jardine?
No questions. I think this is an important step in the right direction, pulling this information together. We need to continue.
Dr. Horn?
I was wondering if you could stop smiling, India. I was wondering if you could describe the relationship in time between the monitoring program and developing standards. How do those two efforts go together?
Well, again, I'll give a two-part answer, if that's all right with you.
Mm-hmm.
One of the parts is we need to examine whether standards are appropriate, new standards are appropriate from a policy level in terms of will that give us the most ammunition to fight these changes or to protect and restore and maintain. And so that's one question. And the other is monitoring is needed so that we have enough data to be able to, if we decide to go forward and adopt new standards, or even to provide that analysis of if it's appropriate, we need data to be able to do that, to go through that process. And if we were to develop new standards, it's a pretty intensive process to meet the EPA's the EPA's standard for adopting standards. excuse me for not having a better word there. And so we don't want to just adopt the standard for with 1 year's data or with data that's been taken every 10 years. That can be problematic because it's not necessarily representative. And so I imagine that depending on the intensity of our monitoring, we would need a few years at least to figure out, especially with the variability in seasons here, to have the data to move forward with that.
Okay. So, I mean, so a certain amount of monitoring has to happen before a new policy of whether it's a standard or not is in place, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and you know, if you remember Alan's slide, I want to say it was slide 20, let's say, 21, there we go. There's the databases for these different nearshore metrics ranges from poor to moderate to good, and so some of them would need more extensive monitoring than others to get to that threshold. And I'm not real familiar with the standard process as defined by the United States EPA. A member of the EPA in here might be able to more address that more directly if you have specific questions.
Could we go to slide 25, Sue? So, and this is a question, there's a lot of fabulous expertise in the room, so anybody who wants to answer this question, I welcome you to answer this question, too. Let's hear everyone's perspective on this. But you get the first crack. So keeping our focus, because we are a water quality agency, keeping our focus on what we can do to improve the nearshore conditions. I would like some feedback from you about which of these. So, I mean, there's the nice to know list, things we'd like to know about the nearshore environment. And then there's, I'm sure, a smaller subset of these items that's need to know in order to improve nearshore conditions. And I'd just like your thoughts on the nice to know versus the need to know list.
Well, I think it's nice to know about turbidity, but I think it's more important to know about transmissivity in the nearshore. It's more appropriate after, because the level of clarity that we have in the lake is how did you describe it? So, like, our standard might be 1 NTU, but usually if you do a survey, you're getting a tenth of that as a measurement, and so transmissivity might be a little bit more appropriate for the nearshore. Would be one example. I see someone to my left who might have other ideas.
I did want to point out that we developed this as pretty much the bare bones minimalist approach to monitoring the nearshore, and so it's designed as an integrated holistic approach to evaluating nearshore conditions. It's hard to pull one of these out without unraveling the actual construction itself. On the other hand, there are some things here that would perhaps be implemented later or at a reduced scale. And obviously, toxicity and harmful microorganisms is one of those, primarily because there are existing programs associated with the beaches and with the water purveyors that do some tracking. We document this in the report. But the rest of it is pretty important. And if we don't, for example, we could say, well, you know, macroinvertebrates, you know, those are bugs, you know, just bugs in the nearshore. How important is that? And the fact is, if we don't have the baseline information now before conditions change much more, then we're not going to be able to say in the future what changes have occurred and what conditions were like in the past. And we really don't have much information on macroinvertebrates in the nearshore. Dan talked briefly about turbidity and transmissivity. Those are up there, both are up there. Ultimately, we assume that as the monitoring program is implemented and we're able to establish the relationships between turbidity and transmissivity, that we would probably end up dropping one of those simply because turbidity is not as reliable at the very low, at the very high clarity conditions we see in Lake Tahoe. Transmissivity is a much better measurement of water clarity at the very low levels we see in Lake Tahoe. But really, this was designed as an integrated program. From the Lahan perspective, there may be some of these things that are more important than others. And certainly the agency has different needs and different objectives than, for example, the TRPA and perhaps the Nevada Division of Environmental Protection. So internally, Lahontan may have some specific priorities that would pull a few of these out and say, well, you know, if we're going to get rolling, we need to get rolling on these right now and depend on our associates and our associated mm-hmm. agencies to backfill some of the things that they see as important. Mm-hmm. That certainly is true. But the program itself was designed to be an integrated, minimalist approach. So. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And if I could add one more thing, I think what your question gets to is the cost of the program, and if we only have, you know, we don't know exactly how much funding we'll be able to find. And so if we can find funding for all this between ourselves and the other agencies, then it'd be great to go forward. Exactly as it's written. If we can find more funding, we'll see what. I'm not super optimistic on that. Mm-hmm. But let's say we aren't able to find enough funding for all these things, then what do we do? And that gets to what I was speaking about earlier about with the Nearshore Agency Working Group and in consultation, obviously, with my management. Nailing down really where in here we can find efficiencies. And it might be that we do an early push. This is just speculative, but it might be that we do an early push and get a few years of everything and then focus less frequent monitoring or less of these. Or, you know, there's options that we'll just have to figure out as we determine the situation funding-wise that we find ourselves in.
Yeah, and I think that it would be good from the Lahontan standpoint to set some priorities because we're not in the same funding world that we were in 10 years ago. And I think, you know, the public is expecting to see some progress in the nearshore environment, and we have to figure out how we can get some progress, get some measurable progress quickly. I understand. From the presentation, it seems. But one of the things I'm taking away from it is that periphyte and phytoplankton are really, really important to the conditions in the nearshore environment. And I mean, I understand that nitrogen and phosphorus is taken up really quickly, so there's not a good one-to-one correlation between the levels of the nutrients and what you see in terms of the periphyte and phytoplankton. But it seems to me we need to have a handle on the inputs, the rate at which nitrogen and phosphorus are coming into the lake. Are they coming into the lake in pulses the way, you know, big rocks move in stream systems? I mean, I just don't know. And if we're going to get a handle on those parts of the ecosystem, then we have to know what the controlling factors are and how we can control them.
You're absolutely right, and we do address this in the report. The fact is that this study was for the nearshore to develop a nearshore monitoring program. So what's coming into the nearshore is a different assessment, and there are programs that are being developed now, urban stormwater monitoring programs, the LTEMP program for stream inputs, that will assess. How much is being loaded into the lake and where. The linkage between the nearshore program and the loading monitoring that's going on in the watershed is that with the nearshore program, we will be able to define areas that are outside expected conditions. And we can say this is a place that seems to be showing unusual deterioration or higher phytoplankton or periphyton growth than we're seeing in other areas. This is an area where the watershed monitoring should be focused. That's that causal assessment again, to look at what is the loading rate here? What's going on? Why is this area different? Is it because of stormwater input through conveyance to the nearshore at this location? Or is it something else? Is it associated with, for example, potentially groundwater seepage from some leaky sewer line potentially, or something like that. So there are programs to look at loading, but that was seen in the context of this report as being a separate program from the nearshore that would link. So these programs would ultimately link, and that's the way in which they would link. The nearshore monitoring in terms of response variables then would direct causal assessments in the watershed to determine what is the contributing factor, what are the loading rates that's causing the change, and the differences around the nearshore.
Thank you.
One other thing I should point out is we've been through this process a few times with a couple of different programs, and generally, you know, we're asked to develop in terms of a monitoring program. You know, what we would like to see as scientists, and what the agency, our agency colleagues typically then refer to as the Cadillac version, and then come back and ask for us to develop a Yugo approach. And against the advice of my colleagues, the co-authors that you saw at the beginning, I chose instead just to do the Yugo version of the monitoring plan this time. This is not a monitoring plan or approach that was designed to be scaled back. Again, you would have, as the Lawton board, specific interests, specific priorities. But we did not design this as an embellished monitoring program, and that we can start slicing off pieces and taking it apart and put this part here and say, well, we don't need the CD and we don't need the satellite radio and we don't need the leather seats, you know. This program doesn't have any of that. It is designed to provide us with an integrated look at how conditions are changing in the nearshore. And initially, Dan is right, there is a bit more put into it at the beginning, because you need to define the variability in your conditions initially in order to determine the frequency and the spatial distribution required to do a more effective and cost-efficient approach. So usually we kind of do it, you have to put a little bit more in the beginning to figure out where you can save it going down the line. And that's an important thing that we haven't done typically in the past, is we've never looked at these programs as being kind of adaptable and something that you can change to focus on specific needs and to reduce over time. And this program, I think we took that approach. The idea was, we want to get this program started so that we can define at this point in time what conditions are in Lake Tahoe and what the in the nearshore, and what is required then for a more efficient monitoring program going forward. But we won't be able to make that assessment until we have the base data to say what the variability is in most of these metrics, because we haven't done it before. We haven't been out there measuring most of these things.
Thank you. I don't have any request cards, I don't think, from the audience, but I don't want to preclude anyone who might have a comment. Yes, sir.
Chair, if I could add one more thing on the monitoring.
Yes.
Which is just that we have a list of quite a few metrics on here, and it's not that we're not doing all of them right now. So this includes some of our current efforts with parasiticides, some of our current efforts with chlorophyll, and there's been some natural value work as well. But just wanted to throw that in there.
Thank you.
Very interesting presentation. I'm Alan Miller. I'm chief of the regulatory unit here in North office here. And it seemed like almost like we're dealing with two different lakes from the thermal stratification level. Mm-hmm. In the summertime, we've got an upper shallow lake, and then this deep lake where in the upper part there's lots of stuff going on, mixing with sun and wind and all that. And the input's coming in through the streams. And then I wondered also, is there the deep lake, the clarity standard out in the middle of the lake, so like a mid lake, area, and then there's the shoreline. So it's very interesting that had you looked at, had the researchers or Alan looked at the possibility that some of the tapering off that he mentioned of the clarity losses in Lake Tahoe are related to absorption around the shoreline, that in effect a lot of those nutrients are being absorbed and transformed into periphyte and algae before they ever reach that deep lake where the monitoring is going on. That was my question. Thank you.
Good question. Nice research topic. Which actually gives me an opportunity to talk about the relationship between monitoring and research. We tend to think that these happen in isolation, and to some extent they do. But I want to mention that the reason we know so much about the mid-lake of Tahoe is because it hasn't been simply the mid-lake monitoring program that you've all been supporting over the years, that UC Davis and the other research institutions in the area have been maintaining with funding that comes from the agencies. We use this as the infrastructure on which we can layer then important research questions that allow us to think forward and think in advance and address issues before they become public problems. And so, you know, science has... Our understanding of the lake has changed over time as the science has advanced, as we know more about what's going on. And the environment itself is not static either. Conditions have changed, irrespective of what we're doing in the lake. And having a monitoring program in place that is just a bare bones, you go out, you take your measurements, you take your samples, you come back, that gets analyzed, and it gets reported on a regular basis. It's just simple work. But on that, we are able to layer research questions by finding extra funding, not necessarily coming to the agencies, but writing grant proposals and finding the money then to fund a graduate student, to fund a little research project, to address an interesting question that as scientists we're thinking, well, this could be important. This may be something that we need to look about and think about in the future. For example, the shift, if you remember in the 80s, the way the nutrient limitation shifted from nitrogen, classic nitrogen-limited lake, to a phosphorus-limited lake. That's the kind of thing that that we're able to address in a pilot study, and then if it looks like it's important, then we bring it into the program, and that's how the monitoring and our understanding and regulation of the system evolves over time. But without that monitoring program in place on which then we can layer interesting research questions, then we just simply don't have the resources to be able to go out and do a little study. Right now I have a grad student. We put in a proposal to the Nevada Division of State Lands last year for a pilot implementation of this nearshore project. And it was accepted and it was going to be funded. But because of the relationship and the interaction between the states on what was going on with SB 630 and with the nearshore and stuff, they decided to delay that until next year when those issues had been resolved. And that was a policy decision. It was made for good policy reasons. But I have a grad student right now who I brought on for a limited period of time who's been trying to do the nearshore work. And we're not going out with our boat to do any nearshore monitoring. And so I'm going to have her, like, walk out and take samples in the nearshore by hand. You know, or she can rent a little canoe and go out, you know, and do that. That's not the way to address our problems in the nearshore at Lake Tahoe. So we need the monitoring program not simply to evaluate how conditions are changing, but also to support the ability to implement little pilot research projects so that we can anticipate problems before they become big issues for us. My little pitch for help and support for our collaborative program, just from the agencies and the researchers kind of working together.
Thank you, and thank you all for a most interesting and challenging presentation. I'm really looking forward to seeing the follow-up on this. It's exciting, it's daunting, and it's a extreme amount of work. I was going to use a different adjective, perhaps I shouldn't. So what I'd like to do now is thank you again for the presentation and take a 10-minute break. Then we'll come back to the next item in the agenda.